in Washington, D.C. When I first moved there, there were, you know, maybe two restaurants worth going to. Downtown was a ghost town after 5 o'clock in the evening. And, you know, in the past 30 years, it has just taken off. And I relish the idea that perhaps I could play a small part in helping make that happen in a place as beautiful as Jacksonville.
That was Mari Koraishi, president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund. Mari is our guest for episode 8 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview. Everybody, I want to introduce you today to Mari Koraishi. She is our latest guest for Innovate Jax and a rock star that Jacksonville gets to need to know. Let's start with your background. Tell us where you grew up. And I can see from, you know, some information that's published about you that you had education abroad in your formative years. Fill us in. Why was that? Tell us what it was like.
Sure. So thank you for having me on your show. Jacksonville is an incredibly welcoming place, and this is yet another example of how welcome you are that you've got me on your show. I grew up all over the place. I was born in Japan. I'm actually, my parents are Japanese. My dad worked for a cosmetics company, so I grew up all over the place because his job took him all over the place. So I grew up in Japan. I grew up in Italy. I grew up in Germany, and then I came here for college. So the reason I was in all of these places isn't anything to do with me. It's got everything to do with my dad's job.
Oh, how about it? And what was that like for you? Was that, you know, being the perpetual traveler hard to adjust, or was it an adventure all the way?
I think it happened early enough in my life that it, you know how when you grow up, you take everything as a given?
Mm.
And so it was a given. We moved around, and that was our life. And
Right. It
was only when I started getting into, you know, like my teens, like, wait, why don't I get to stay? Why don't, like, my friends get to stay here and live out their lives in the school that we love and everything? But I have to leave. This is not fair.
Right.
So it was really only then that I started feeling like, well, you know, that's, hang on a second. This isn't everyone else's experience. But having said that, you know, I think for myself, it was an adventure. It was something, I'm reasonably good at languages. So picking up a new language as we moved wasn't as big a deal as it might have been. And, you know, I think over the years, it's become part of my thing, that I am a quick study, that I relish coming into new situations and getting to figure things out, like that figuring out process. And, you know, even something as simple as like, where's a great bakery, right? That's a fun thing for me to figure out, as opposed to, oh, I'm no longer in this place where I knew where the best bakery was.
Wow. And not daunting, but no, something that you embrace.
Yeah.
Well, Mari, I was reading about, again, some of this literature that you have published even on your own LinkedIn profile, and you linked to an article where it seems like you had a really formative experience. You grew up, or part of your high schooling was in Western Germany.
Yes,
when there
at
was
the time.
In East and West Germany, so we're talking early 80s, and you had an experience that I think kind of influenced maybe the trajectory of maybe what you took with you into your career, if not the actual career. So why don't you share with our audience what that was?
I was in high school at the time. Our senior field trip was to the divided city of Berlin, which was at that time in the East German side of Germany. And if you recall, Berlin was divided into the Soviet bloc and the Western blocs. Berlin was actually divided into the British, French, and American sectors. The Western sectors ultimately became one, but the Soviet sector became separate. And as you might recall, when the Berlin Wall was built by the Soviets, it walled off East Berlin from West Berlin. And that wall had, there were two parts to the wall. And in between the two separate walls was this place called No Man's Land. And it was mined. It had, you know, barbed wire across. It was basically made to prevent East Germans from escaping into the western part of Berlin through the wall. And, it, of course, it became a tourist site for the western side of the wall. And they used to have these little stands where you could go up the this platform and you could look into the no man's land between East Berlin and West Berlin. And, you know, like any good tourist group, our 12th grade class showed up there. And like any 12th grade class, we were noisy and, you know, obnoxious, pointing at things across the way. And I distinctly recall looking into East Berlin and seeing people walking around in there with shopping bags, carrying briefcases, whatever. And they did not turn around to look at us. And we were being quite loud. And it was really striking to me that because everyone at some level kind of realizes when someone's looking at you. It must be some, you know, deep-seated survival instinct that you know when someone's looking at you. And so you naturally usually want to turn around to see who that is. But the East Germans had gotten used enough to the idea of Westerners looking over the wall at them, but also steeled themselves to not look. And so that really made me curious as to the regime that had, you know, sort of created these incentives. And that's ultimately one of the reasons why I ended up studying the Soviet Union, why I studied Russian and became a Sovietologist, criminologist when I went to college and grad school.
Really profound impact. It's interesting. It's just one of those things that here you were probably a 17 or 18-year-old, and that was a pivotal point for you. Mm-hmm. So, well, let's talk then. You then moved to the United States.
Yes, went for college.
Went to Harvard, mm-hmm. got your undergraduate degree, and then into a master's program mm-hmm. and a PhD program mm-hmm. All around Russian studies. And that was very fortuitous for you because at the time that you were getting ready to, you know, maybe change out of school, you discovered this position at the World Bank. And lo and behold, they needed someone to help with their Russian program. Right. So can you explain for us, you know, maybe start with the definition of what the World Bank is, what it does,
sure.
and then what your role was there, because it's
yeah.
very fascinating.
The World Bank is an international treaty organization. It was set up in a similar way to the UN and the International Monetary Fund, but it's basically a bunch of countries getting together and saying, we are going to do some things together. In the case of the World Bank, it really is a bank. And sovereign countries have capital thresholds that they are required to meet as a function of their GDP. So if you're a richer country, you have to contribute more capital. If you're not as rich, then you contribute less capital. But you all contribute capital. All the sovereign nations that are part of the World Bank have capital in the World Bank. Some of it is paid in, some of it is callable, but the gist of it is that this is an international financial institution with a lot of capital, which it then leverages to make loans to some of its members, not all of its members. Basically, the criteria for receiving loans from the World Bank is your GDP per capita. So if you're a poorer country, you get loans from the World Bank. If you're a richer country, you don't get loans from the World Bank. And these loans are for public goods. These are for roads, for education, for macroeconomic support. This is loans made to the sovereign governments of the borrowing countries. And the loans are on preferential terms because, you know, this is callable capital from the EU, the United States, Japan. So the cost of borrowing for the World Bank is low, which is then possible to pass on to, you know, say, Malawi, which is a borrowing country. And needless to say, I had no idea of any of this when I put in my resume to the World Bank. I was a Sovietologist. I understood ICBMs. I understood, you know, nuclear deterrence, looking at people on the Kremlin wall and saying, oh, that's going to be the next general secretary of the Soviet Union. I didn't understand the sort of structure of the World Bank, what it did. I just knew that I was in a PhD program studying a country that had just imploded on itself, and my discipline, political science, had failed to predict the single most important thing that had happened to my unit of analysis, which no longer existed, and I just needed out. So I sent a resume to the World Bank because I heard that they were hiring Russian specialists, and through sheer luck, I was selected to join the World Bank and ended up working, six plus years in the Russia country division, making structuring loans for the world, for Russia. Now, the backstory as to why they were hiring at that time is that the Soviet Union had, although it was part of the UN and other things, it had refused to join the World Bank. And so it was only when the Soviet Union dissolved that the actual republics that had made up the Soviet Union actively joined the World Bank and became eligible to receive loans from the World Bank. So it was a complete greenfield program, as in the World Bank had made no loans to Russia or any of the Soviet republics, and this included Latvia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan. All of those republics had never had World Bank projects in their countries. So when I joined, it was the very beginning of that process, and we got to go into the countries and start figuring out, well, what are its needs? What should we put in place? And remember, this isn't just a relatively underdeveloped economy. This is a country that had been a planned economy, so it didn't have any market institutions to support market operations. So it was very special in that regard. We had to build up everything from scratch, whether it was the equivalent of the Securities and Exchange Commission or the financial oversight bodies that would oversee the development of the banking sector. So all of these things were in play. I was, 25. My counterparts in the government were equally young because these were the Soviet Union's old bureaucrats were discredited, and they knew how to run planned economies. So they hired all these extremely young people who had been studying economics in Austria or other places, who knew something about market economics. And, I spoke Russian because I'd been studying all of this stuff, not intending to use it for this purpose, but here we were. And, I don't know, you mentioned that you had studied the Russian Revolution, so you might know, but the Russians are incredibly friendly. So here we would be sitting around the kitchen table with bottles of vodka, and someone would inevitably bring out a guitar. Every Russian that I met at the time knew all the lyrics to the Beatles songs. They would pull out their guitars, Three Sheets to the Wind anyway. They'd start strumming, Beatles songs, and we'd be sitting there saying, okay, so what do we do to make privatization irreversible?
All right, Mari, I have to stop you. In your wildest dreams, did you think that you at age 25 were going to be in the role that you were in, creating, in this greenfield space in these republics that are now suddenly free? Did you ever imagine that you would have that kind of authority to be part of that future?
Oh, no, not at all.
I mean,
and as I told you, I had no idea what the World Bank was doing when I threw my resume.
Right.
I expected to be, working at the NSA in some analyst job, right, reading, Pravda.
And here you are interacting face to face in, yes, someone's kitchen, trying to figure out how you're going to. I know housing was a very big focus,
yes,
from what I understand. So what did you draw from internally to give you the confidence to do this job? I think some people might have run in the opposite direction, just thinking about, I'm not ready to do this. And here you were. It didn't stop you. So
no,
was it just embracing the new that you said, moving
part
around the world?
Part of it is embracing the new,
yeah,
I think. And, I think this assumption that I can figure this out.
Smart woman, yes.
So that's that I think was probably part of moving around and saying, you know, so I get plopped into Düsseldorf, Germany, I'm going to figure this out. I think there was that. And then there was even though I was 25, usually the only woman in the room inside World Bank meetings, frequently sort of turned around to and said, would you mind getting us lunch? I spoke Russian. They didn't. So especially when we're in these negotiating situations, we work through translators, don't get me wrong. So there was sequential translation going along.
And
but
perhaps
I was,
parity with the folks that didn't speak Russian, however.
Right. I knew what was being said, and I could tell when the translators were sort of having trouble. And so I think despite my juniority, to flip the seniority phase, I think I felt that I had tools accessible to me that perhaps other people didn't. And therefore, you know, I had something to contribute.
So your most memorable experience from that time abroad, do you have a favorite?
All right. This will be a good one. So we worked on housing, as you said, and in one of the projects related to housing, we went around to different cities, smaller cities, not just Moscow. These were regional capitals. There's a sort of process by which you kind of get to know these mayors and, you know, department heads and whatever. And usually this involves dinner, a lot of drinking, and a lot of toasts. So we're at one of these dinners in a city. I'm there with our Russian counterpart, who is a woman. I'll tell you what she does today, later in the story. My translator, also a woman. Our assistant, who's also a woman. And a guy from the World Bank, who I'll also tell you who the guy is later. And the mayor turns around to the World Bank guy, and we're in the middle of toast, right? And he says, to Denis and his Sputnitsy.
Oh, no.
And for those of you who remember, Sputnik is satellite. Sputnitsa is the female version of Sputnik. So he had just toasted Denis and his female satellites.
Oh.
And, you know, I look around, the translator looks around, Denis has no idea what has just been said. And he's like, let's drink up. And so we all drank up. So the kicker of the story is that the man who, you know, said yes is Denis Whittle, my husband. And our Russian counterpart, Elvira Nabiolina, who was our counterpart at the time on this project, is the chairman of the Russian Central Bank today.
Does your husband remember that well as you do?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Let's get back to your time with the World Bank then. You were abroad then, it sounds like, for several years. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was back and forth.
Back and forth. And then your career evolved with mm-hmm. the World Bank. And I want to make sure everyone knows when we produce this podcast, we have show notes that we publish on our blog. And I will link to the Harvard Business Review article mm-hmm. that covered this really innovative concept that you helped to design and launch for the World Bank, which fundamentally changed how funds were distributed for anti-poverty solutions. So how about if you walk us through that, you know, it was called the Development Marketplace. Mm-hmm. The year was 1998. And maybe again, tell us first how funds were typically distributed at the World Bank, and then tell us why this was such a sea change.
Right. This is about the innovation part of the role that I ended up playing at the World Bank. And, you know, like many other institutions, I think the World Bank had tried to figure out, you know, how should it innovate? And it seems very natural to us now, but cast your mind back 20 years, crowdsourcing wasn't a thing. And so innovation was usually tackled by picking really smart people and putting them in labs or research functions and asking them to come up with bright ideas. And the World Bank had tried that for a while, and they'd had some innovation, some products and some services, but it just didn't seem to be making a dent in the traditional business of the World Bank. And there are probably other reasons. It had nothing to do with the innate, intrinsic quality of the ideas that were being proposed through that system. But I think one of the things that we felt was necessary was to change the culture of the World Bank, which was very much a permissions-based culture. It was not an ask for forgiveness culture. And so anything that was proposed would be run up and down the hierarchy and checked and cross-checked and validated. And really, many ideas never survive that cross-checking. And they're not even given a chance to be tested out. So in an attempt to sort of attack the culture, we said, well, let's do everything that in a very different way. Let's not pre-vet everything. Let's let everything come forward. Let's be able to see the full range of things that come forward. And let's let staff and people in the field give us those ideas, as opposed to trying to find the smart people in the world who will go and research what is going on and then come back and tell us what it is. So the marketplace was really like a science fair on steroids. We just told everybody, come up with your best idea. We will walk around with a jury that will be, you know, the senior leadership of the bank and maybe additional leaders from the development community, and let them, one, see the full range of things that are out there in the world. Two, allow them to interact with the people who were coming up with these incredible ideas. And three, allow those people with the great ideas get an insight into how senior executives at the World Bank or leaders of major NGOs look at issues from their point of view. And let's start that whole dialogue. And then whatever projects are selected will, you know, they'll get money and they'll get support, and that's great. But we will have created one day, or it may have ended up becoming 2 days at this certain point, one or 2 days, the World Bank atrium will be filled with ideas. It will be a buzz. It will be this sort of environment where everyone would feel like they too could be a change maker. So that was the idea behind the marketplace.
And it was wildly successful. Mm-hmm. To the point that Harvard Business Review wrote about it 4 years later. But it's something that continued. And do you think, you know, one thing that I was really taken by in reading about the solutions that came forward, you weren't necessarily awarding multimillion dollar grants.
No.
These were much smaller.
The small amounts of money involved were really a function of our budget. We only had, you know,
$3 million, I think it was.
$3 million at our disposal. The World Bank's total budget is in the billions.
Right.
So we were playing around with small amounts of money, which probably is one of the reasons why it happened, because if we had been playing around with larger amounts of money, I think the powers that be would have been a little bit more concerned that we were opening up the atrium to all sorts of people coming in from the outside.
Did it change the culture, do you think?
I think it began to change the culture. Right. And we were, at least I can say this. I mean, when we did the innovation marketplace and the development marketplace, crowdsourcing wasn't a word. Mm. It was something that really came into the vernacular later. So we were on the bleeding edge in that sense. And I think today, it's everyone thinks it's entirely reasonable to go to, you know, Indiegogo or GoFundMe or any of these platforms where people are coming up with their own ideas about what should be done, and we think that's normal.
Right. And it's hard to think that once upon a time that just didn't exist.
No.
Right. So you, it seems, were so inspired by the opportunities that you saw. As I believe I read, you thought all the ideas that were presented were worth at least amplifying so that more people got to know what these solutions might be. And so helped you take a new pivot in mm-hmm. your career. And you did that with, were you married at the time
no.
to your husband? No. Okay, so you started a radical new platform called Global Giving. And again, brand new here, you know, you're embracing change yet again. It's mm-hmm. a theme that definitely carries through your life. But I think the theme that I don't want to project on you, but it seems very real to me. You're very person focused. You're not going to get lost in the details of the, you know, the infrastructure woes and everything. You are seeing the individual. And as you said in one of your articles, you wanted to unleash people who you felt were leashed or constrained. And so here you create this amazing platform. And I hope you can fill our audience in on Global Giving, what it did and you know, some of the successes that you had
mm-hmm,
with it.
Mm-hmm. So Global Giving, you can find it at globalgiving.org. Is a platform where you can go on and find a project to support in 175 different countries. You can do anything from support orphans in South Africa to building wells to protecting birds to providing clean water, helping the aged. You name it, it's on there. We work with thousands of nonprofits from all over the world. We vet them, and they go through a training process, and we make it possible for you to give money to those organizations and hear back directly as to what your money has done. We work with individuals who find us online, as well as companies. We work with a lot of companies ranging from, you know, Eli Lilly, to Ford Motor Company, to Google, to Facebook, to support their CSR programs. And we're digital first, so everything is virtual, which is not to say that our staff, our teams don't go out into the world, into all sorts of places. The insight from late 2000, which is when we started Global Giving, was that technology had made it possible for us to directly post the projects of small grassroots organizations around the world. Would not have been possible without the World Wide Web, obviously. And I think the scale of Global Giving at this point, we have given out, I think, more than $400 million. The scale of this would not be possible without what happened later. So we were founded in late 2000. Our beta platform went up in 2002. But social media and all of those things came up afterwards. So that made all of the successes of Global Giving possible. And people also got comfortable with giving online. That was not a thing back when we started.
So how is it that you overcame that friction point? I know that your company probably, the Global Giving, vet all of the projects that got to appear on your platform so people could give with confidence. Did you have some sort of rating or, you know?
Yes, there is a rating engine in the background that integrates not just the initial vetting process and whether their financials are sound according to certain criteria that we allocate, but also to what extent they listen to the people they seek to serve, to what extent they are open to learning, to what extent they are responsive to both to donors and to stakeholders. So all of that is factored into an algorithm that determines where your project shows up when you search on the Global Giving site or when you click on a category like India.
You have been the president of the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund since January of mm-hmm. this year. So I am dying to know, after running this incredible global platform for 17 years, what was it about the fund that convinced you it was the right time to make a new move in your career and relocate to Jacksonville, Florida?
Mm-hmm. When I was encouraged to apply for this position, what really struck me about the fund was how it had been just so lovingly stewarded by my predecessor, Sherry McGill, from a small foundation, medium size. But, you know, the corpus had grown tremendously at this point. It's, you know, $300 million, give or take. the governance had been transformed from, you know, Mrs. DuPont's will initially only said that you need a banker and someone nominated by the bishop, the Episcopal bishop of Jacksonville. That was it. Now we have an extremely powerful board that includes people like the head of the Rhodes Trust at Oxford University, the former U.S. treasurer, presidents of universities. This is a institution with a very sophisticated board. It is also an institution that has made a big commitment to downtown in the form of this center in which where we're sitting, the Jesse Ball DuPont Center, which is a former Hayden Burns Library, for those of you who remember it as the main public library in Jacksonville. And I'm a complete sucker for mid-century modern, so that also was another plus. And the fact that Sherry saved this beautiful building from being demolished and, you know, sort of put the funds imprimatur behind the idea that Jacksonville downtown could revitalize and blossom was very attractive. I spent 30 plus years in D.C., and during which I saw the same thing happen in Washington, D.C. When I first moved there, there were, you know, maybe two restaurants worth going to. Downtown was a ghost town after 5 o'clock in the evening. And, you know, in the past 30 years, it has just taken off. And I relish the idea that perhaps I could play a small part in helping make that happen in a place as beautiful as Jacksonville, because, you know, it has its beaches, it's got the St. John's River, it's got, you know, amazing number of parks, the trees in the city. I realize this is extremely stretched out because of the consolidated government. It's the largest city by landmass. I just see so much potential here. And the idea of working in a place where I could actually see the needle move was pretty attractive.
So in your role as president then, what kind of impact, you know, do you have a one-year list of things that you would hope to accomplish? Or, you know, maybe just even tell us what is the focus of the fund itself for people who may not know it outside of the building with the name on it? What change is it hoping to bring about, and how will you steward that?
Yeah. Well, the fund has always been focused on a handful of core communities, of which Jacksonville is one, arguably the most important one because we're based here. And in some ways, our networks are biggest here. Other communities include Port St. Joe on the Gulf Coast, where the DuPonts had a paper mill, which is no longer in operation. Also, the northern neck of Virginia, which is where Mrs. DuPont was from, and Wilmington, Delaware, where, of course, the DuPont family is from. So those states, Delaware, Florida, and Virginia, are named in her will as being areas of focus for the fund. So in some ways, we're very geographically focused. We are place-based. Mrs. DuPont was also a educator. She had been a vice principal of a high school before she got married to Alfred I. DuPont. And she cared deeply about education and its transformative capacity. So we fund a lot of universities and liberal arts colleges, and especially supporting first-generation students to sort of lean into this idea of education as a transformative channel for individuals and households.
Let's look at the span of your career and the fact that you have been able to bring about lasting social change around the world by bringing together disparate parties, governments, businesses, and enterprise, community advocates, people who may not necessarily have a common vision for how something needs to get done, yet you've managed to cobble together these, you know, again, these parties that might be at odds with each other, and you bring about a focus where they work side by side for the common good. What is it that you're going to do here in Jacksonville with this expertise that you have, and how, too, might you help influence our other leaders in this city to think the same way?
I've always believed that many of the political and policy arguments we have are about the how and not about the what. I think it is possible to arrive at agreement on what we want. We want a better Jacksonville. We want a more prosperous Jacksonville. And it's not just about financial wealth. It's about creative wealth. It's about social wealth. It's about our relationships with each other. It's about the beauty with which we surround ourselves, whether it's made through art or nature. We can come to agreement that we want more of those things, and we want more of those things for our children. So once you kind of have agreement there, then I've always been open to different ways of doing things. A long time ago, I realized that however good I may have been at school or, you know, jobs or whatever, at a certain point, I realized my way is not the only way, that there are very many different ways to achieve the same goal, depending on your set of talents and your experience and your assets. And so I'm very undogmatic about the how. And I think there are very many different ways of arriving. And I am much more about what is the way that we can collectively agree to do something rather than it has to be the way I choose to do it. If I can include the largest number of people, I'd much rather do it that way than to do it the way that I might technically think is the best way to do something. It doesn't always work out, but it's the same balance that I was trying to strike in, you know, starting Global Giving as against the World Bank. The World Bank typically would come in and have these experts who would tell you exactly what you should be doing in agriculture extension. Now, they may technically have been right. That may have been technically the best way to run things. But what happens when you have an expert come in and tell you what the right thing is to do, people are like, okay, all right, you tell us, we just do it. And they don't own it.
Right.
And after it fails, they're like, told you so. Right. And they're almost happy that your technical solution failed because they didn't own it. And they're like, but if you have somebody own it and it doesn't work, they're like, wait, I can fix this. I'll go back to the drawing board. I'll make this work. Right. So ownership at the end of the day is far more important than whether something is technically the best of, you know, solution. And over the years, I have learned that it's really ownership. And for ownership, you got to meet people where they are. And you got to find the thing that animates them and that kind of brings you together in purpose. And once you find that thing of purpose to bring you together, you got to let go of any preconceived notions you had coming into it as, well, this is my way of doing things.
You have to let go of ego.
Yeah.
Really.
And your sense of, competence and professionalism, I think, that in many ways sort of makes up our personal identities, right? And that's not who you are. You may be an awesome lawyer, and people may come to you for legal advice. But, you know, when you're with your kids, you don't kind of lean back into your lawyer identity and say, well, I'm the best lawyer in town here, son, so you better listen to me. No, it's about your relationship with your son and whether your son buys into what you're saying. And if he doesn't, then it doesn't matter that you're the best lawyer in town.
I love everything that you're saying around that. Do you just model the way, Mari? I mean, again, how do you help people who are interested in that kind of leadership? You know, it's, that style of leadership. Maybe they haven't reported into people that model that way. And it's a culture like a World Bank of old that was very bureaucratic and you know, a top-down philosophy. How is it that you help people break through that kind of barrier if one exists for them?
So usually there are ways to find green fields of experimentation because nobody, unless they're true control freaks, insists on everything being done their way. There are pockets of freedom. So one is, when I'm mentoring somebody, I usually say, just look for those pockets of freedom and see whether you can sort of exercise your creativity and your own leadership and your own initiative that way. For those people who are looking to sort of change their own leadership styles, a long time ago I read a case study, a Harvard Business School case study about a electricity company. They had a generation plant, and they had janitors and workers, blue-collar workers, at the plant. And, you know, like any electricity company, they had cash that they needed to manage and earn an interest from. They did the radical thing of bringing together a group of blue-collar workers to oversee cash management. I mean, they were paired up with financial experts. But they were told, okay, well, your financial expert's there to help you and give you guidance, but you should learn how to manage cash. And they said, yeah, we earned probably a little bit less than we might have, but we got the smartest janitors out. You know, they, for them, it was a way of making these people feel completely invested in what the company did and the success of the company.
Right.
It was giving them a stake. It was giving them skills. It was giving them professional experience at the cost of a couple of points on their cash management, which they might have otherwise spent on professional development fees. Right.
Right.
So I just found that such an incredibly illustrative example of what you can do to sort of turn things upside down a little bit. It reminds me also of the story of, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but when, you know, someone visited Cape Canaveral, they asked a janitor, you know, who's sweeping up something, and saying, so what do you do here? Well, I'm helping put a man on the moon, sir. That janitor was just sweeping the floor. But he felt that his job was critical to getting a man on the moon. I mean, you get that kind of ownership.
Mm.
You can achieve amazing things.
Mm.
And so as a leader, I think the payoff is that you get exponentially higher ownership and commitment and creativity when you allow people room to sort of experiment, fail if necessary, but then they're like 110% in instead of 25% in.
Love that story. Love that story. Great advice. I have one final question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in your life's experience of giving, there are other people like you who want to make a lasting social impact, and maybe they have a great idea, but they don't know how to get started. What advice do you have for someone who might want to really make a change in the world and doesn't know how to start?
So if you have an idea that can help the world, go talk to the people first who you think might be feeling the pain around this thing that you want to make happen in the world, but that doesn't exist yet, because they will be all in and saying, yes, I will help you sort this out. I will connect you to the people in, you know, in the tech world or in the finance world that will help you sort this out, because there are people feeling the pain like you. And I think they will give you nights and weekends time to help make that idea happen.
Thank you so much for your time today. It has been a pleasure meeting you. And I hope that everybody will read our show notes and learn more about your backstory and more about the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, because it's doing amazing things here in Jacksonville.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Verqura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Verqura.com. Thanks for listening.